Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Welcome along to the Gallipoli Club tonight, where our two speakers make welcome returns to the Sydney Institute. Ollie Boczetski and Alice Grundy. Ollie, on the occasion of the release of the book which he's co-authored with Graham Jones called Paris Tragics, Two Aussie Blokes Tackle the Art, Food and History of Paris, and Alice Grundy, because she hasn't written a book on Paris, I think, so at the Sydney Institute we always go for balance, so there we are. But Alice has been here before. She's spoken at the Sydney Institute on literary festivals. Ollie was here speaking on his best-selling book on leadership some years ago. And the topic for tonight is, believe it or not, why, oh why, do we love Paris? Now, who's going first? Alice is going first, thank you. No one ever tells me. Alice, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jared. I think my qualification for being here is that I lived there and that's it. So this is my take on the fantasy, the reality and the aftermath of living in Paris. I don't know about you, but I was a very moody, very intelligent, and terrifically misunderstood teenager. No one, it seemed to me, had seen the world quite the way that I saw it, nor were they as fully cognizant of the ethical dilemmas that simply existing presented. This was Canberra in the 90s. The summers burn the grass brown, and the winters freeze it. The population was homogenous, for the most part, and the culture was bordering non-existent. So I thought that I was alone, except for when I was kept company by European or American classics. It was into this quite smallish world that my good friend introduced Sartre to me, more specifically, the Roads to Freedom series that begins with The Age of Reason. Finally, I thought to myself, as I sat reading in one of Canberra's few dingy cafes, finally, someone has articulated the thoughts that up until that point had been floating, cloud-like and amorphous, in my adolescent mind. Finally, someone was trying to develop a system for a world without God, and aesthetics and ethics that were internally consistent, highly moral, and which left the individual both accountable and in control of their will and their role in the world. And the home of this brand of philosophy that I was discovering some 50-odd years after the fact? Why, France, of course. What made existentialism such a popular philosophy for my sort of person, and still does, was the way that it empowered the individual and spoke of a world that was morally accountable in the absence of God. It was very important for me to live ethically. Of course, I've jettisoned many of those sorts of ideas now that I'm 30, but at the time, the childhood faith in fairness still ran strong, and particularly in dreary winters sitting on lurid orange and blue buses tooling around Canberra suburbs to visit my friends, the prospect of high culture and a world of artistic integrity, a world where, as one character in The Age of Reason does, one might stab one's own hand during a discussion in a cafe just to prove a point. This showed me that body and mind I was supposed to be in Paris. It seemed at the time, and in fact still seems, that many Australians cringe at the idea of culture, whereas France, that far-off dreamscape, celebrated artists. It had housed some of the most significant thinkers of the 20th century, and we were barely in the 21st. The plaudits of the last millennium still held significant power over me. To imagine a world where I could tell people I was going to be a writer and have them respect it rather than ask, and what will your real job be? So inspired was I by these books and the Camus that I read subsequently that I was determined to move to Paris to become a writer and live an authentic life. In large part, I can credit the deep rooting of my obsession to the naysayers. When people asked me what I wanted to do, I said study literature and then live in Paris. Time and again, many told me it would never happen, which of course made me ever more determined to make it so. The language has been part of my life from birth in that my mother, who studied French at university, spoke it to me on occasion. But it was only ever to caution or cajole. Ne le touche pas, fais attention à Nice. Like many Australian school children, I began learning French properly at primary school. The standard of language teaching in this country is, in my experience, and in what I have encountered in others, terrible. Compare the spoken English of Germans or Danes for an embarrassment of linguistic riches. But nonetheless, French and France have been part of my experience of the world for the better part of my life. When I meet peers in China or India, or indeed in France, they are surprised to hear that as late as the 90s, French and German were the dominant languages taught in Australian schools. In the time since I finished, I believe there have been some developments, and it's now possible to study such exotic languages as Indonesian or Mandarin, but these weren't even options when I was at school. Japanese had just been introduced and was gaining popularity, but the teachers certainly weren't Japanese themselves, and I felt dubious at their skills in the language. This familiarity with French, and by extension with the culture, the films, books and television, was an immediate and direct link to the other side of the world. Holding French words in my mouth, learning their expressions and obsessing over their literature and films equipped me with an affinity even before I had cracked my first Sartre. At university, I continued to study the French, the writers, that is, not the language, Descartesian philosophy, for instance. But I also discovered more about the influence, the draw that France, and particularly Paris, has had on my favourite writers and thinkers. Jean Rhys, Vladimir Nabokov, Gertrude Stein. The Paris of the early 20th century was particularly vivid in my mind. In a modernism subject, the lecturer waxed lyrical about Sylvia Beach of the Left Bank Bookshop, Shakespeare & Co., who was the first publisher of Ulysses. That Americans smuggled copies of that blue dust-jacketed hardback in their suitcases, bringing this radical new work to the States where it had been banned, tickled my imagination. Shakespeare & Co., although no longer in its original location, nor the two where Beach looked after the store, it's still open, and the internet told me that it was possible not only to visit, but that creative writing workshops in English took place in its upper wood-panelled rooms, an intoxicating thought indeed. The last element in solidifying the fantasy was the knowledge of the Schengen visa. For 1 year, if you have $10,000 in your bank account and a return ticket to your country of origin and no police record, an Australian aged under 30 can receive a 1 year working holiday visa to European countries that are signatories of the Schengen agreement. If it hadn't been for the money, I would have left directly after university. So in order to save up, I worked in terrible places like think tanks. Even the Sydney Institute. They had me back for a while after putting up with me all through university. And then for a little while in the public service in a job where I had to log all incoming mail by hand in a department that had a very long name that for cultural reasons could not be abbreviated. At the end, I had RSI and enough money for a visa. So a year later, with my police check and my visa and my plane tickets, a place to stay, or my boyfriend who had decided to come, and one small suitcase, I hopped on a plane for Paris in February 2008. And now we move to the reality. Being Gen Y, of course, I started a blog about my trip. And reading back over that blog now in preparation for this talk, aside from cringing at the terrible writing and string of bad haircuts, I can see that much of the early days in Paris were spent walking. Paris is such a kind city to pedestrians. Although we arrived at the tail end of winter and the days were cold, and of course coming from Sydney I didn't have a decent coat, there was always a cafe or a bar or boulangerie where I could sate one craving or another and emerge restored into the fresh air. I had learnt the term flaneur and was keen to embody it, taking a notebook everywhere with me, pausing to write down my thoughts and to work on my book. Of course I was writing a book at the time. Although finding a job should have been the first priority, what really came first was joining the writers' group at Shakespeare & Co. and trundling along with a direly underdeveloped first draft of a first chapter of a novella. There I met a young English woman who, kind to strangers, having been a newcomer to Paris less than a year before, took me in hand and got me a job at the Rose Bakery, an organic or bio cafe run by a Frenchman and his English wife, sending trendy English organic food and appealing to actresses and models and wealthy locals of the 9th arrondissement. The middle part, south of Pigalle, for those who know it. You'll remember my referencing the paucity of language teaching in Australia. Though part of my poor French was my own fault for having stopped studying in year 11, nevertheless, I thought I had enough to work in a cafe, especially an English one. For the vegetarians who were accidentally served meat, those who spoke too quickly for me to follow, and the aging French movie stars I failed to recognise, I'm sorry. Language was not just a hindrance at work, but also in social scenarios. One evening I was invited to a party at a friend's place whose father had a vineyard in Champagne. We were drinking liberally, I wore my blackest ensemble and felt very sophisticated. A few hours in, I met my host and I was delighted to thank him for his hospitality. and especially since it was my first party in Paris, except that I used the word boum instead of soirée, and he burst out laughing. He called his friends over and asked me to repeat my comment a half dozen times. They all cackled. I had to beg for an explanation. Another problem with finishing French studies so early was this. A boum is the kind of party 12-year-olds have in their parents' garages. Adults go to soirées. This is a mistake I wouldn't make again. I'd like to believe that these sorts of errors are small, and everyone trying to speak French must make the same errors all the time. But those who haven't experienced a linguistic glitch like this, it can be quite embarrassing. While my peers in Australia will try to follow someone speaking with an accent and can often make a good guess as to what the foreigner is saying even without understanding all the words, there's a stubborn intransigence to the French ear, and they have difficulty understanding anyone who makes even slight changes, inadvertent or otherwise, to the language. A minor mispronunciation will often lead to a total communication breakdown, even if the context of the sentence and the words they can understand should give them enough information to figure out the word I have butchered. Things like quartier and quartier, foie and foie, or the eternal bane of my waitressing life, merci, which is blueberry. It calls to mind Hermia's importuning Demetrius in Midsummer Night's Dream. The more you beat me, I will fawn on you. Use me but as your spaniel. Spurn me, strike me, neglect me, lose me. Only give me leave, unworthy as I am, to follow you. As Australia is yet to recover from cultural cringe, the very disdain that some French have for our attempts at their language, at their style, their food, make us only love them the more for it. Over 3 months waitressing, my biceps grew, as did my vocabulary, and I only gave a half dozen people the wrong order. But the long days, the lettuce washing and the toilet cleaning weren't exactly what I had imagined for my Paris sojourn. So when I saw a sign in a dress shop down the street from my apartment asking for applications, I was quick to go inside and introduce myself. They accepted my application once I had attached a passport photo, because in France you always have to supply a photo and often a handwriting sample, and I had a job within the week. This was significantly better for my language acquisition, since my fellow shop girls were studying French literature at university and enjoyed teaching me the quirks of grammar. And even better, idioms. There's a French equivalent to spoonerisms called contrepétrie. For those interested, I can share an example afterwards, though it's not appropriate for speaking into a microphone or printing in the city papers. Around this time, I began to understand some of the politics around weight and gender and to decode some of the things that people were saying to me. For instance, when my colleague said, "Oh, it's so great that you can eat that," referring to a falafel from one of the best joints in the whole world that was just down the street, what they were really saying is, "I can't believe you eat that. No wonder you're bigger than me." They would leave their diet pills in the shop bathroom so their boyfriends wouldn't accidentally stumble on them at home. It wasn't limited to supplements, though. During the day, they would eat next to nothing, the standard black coffee and cigarettes, so that in the evenings they could eat normally in front of men and appear nonchalant about food. My sample is admittedly limited, but these were intelligent university students in the 21st century, and still they masked their eating habits from their boyfriends. The conservatism, in other ways, came up regularly at the shop. The designer was from Corsica, and her clothes featured bright colours and vivid patterns. Customers, on hearing my accent, would ask where I was from and then conclude aloud, "So the designer is Australian." When I assured them that she was French, they were incredulous, often contradicting me, as if it was impossible that a true French person would use colour. Another serendipitous arrangement arose just at the end of the summer when an internship at a literary agency came up. I was eager to try another world as 3 months had passed, and the wind down of tourist season at the dress shop would mean fewer shifts. And having always been a bookish person, its appeal was significant. In the dress shop, my boss was looking through applications for my replacement and wouldn't look past the photo. Any applicant who wasn't white immediately went into the no pile. Hijab, no. Algerian, no. Even blondes were less quickly accepted. He seemed to be a fan of brunettes, and I came to understand how I'd been given the job, since I knew by now how terrible my French had been in the interview. My last job was altogether different, interning at Susanna Lee Associates, the eponymous literary agency of an English agent and her French husband. Unutterably glamorous, I remember her breaking in some YSL platform shoes the week before Frankfurt Book Fair as she zipped off to meetings with authors and publishers, dinner with Bono. These last few months, although still bringing on waves of disgust at the inadequacy of my French, I learnt about the literary world, the cycles of the publishing houses, and how France's protectionism has resulted in an industry that flourishes in some senses, but is utterly stifled in others. I never wanted to leave, even though many French people I met, particularly those around my own age, were incredulous that I wanted to live there. They saw it as a limited has-been country, too narrow and colonial-minded. To them, Australia was a land of possibility and, above all, sunshine. Where I saw culture, they saw baggage. I was desperate to stay. I had more than a few plans of passport swapping, and my boyfriend, with his English passport, proposed to me so that we could remain in our Paris bubble. He proposed on a bridge over the Seine in the rain with a ring whose glass bauble was filled with purple liquid, representing my preference for writing with a purple fountain pen. Oh, it was so Paris. But in the end, we had to come back. And now we reach the aftermath. Coming home involved a grieving process. We returned to Canberra and were house-sitting in a dried-up suburb during a heat wave, the sun burning the grass, and we felt that we'd gone to Mars, not the capital of a Western country. We planned to incorporate as much of our Paris life back into Sydney. Things like only having a bar fridge and going shopping every day, not having a television, creating a writing group, never eating bread more than 3 hours old, telling people, without flinching, I am a writer. I can report that bar fridges don't work in Sydney, and nor does shopping every day. I haven't been a writer for 8 years, and Sydney bakeries simply don't make bread 5 times a day, so sadly, I've slipped back into old habits. Coming home did have its benefits, though. Prospective employers imagined that I would have a degree of sophistication having just returned from one of the world's most beautiful and cosmopolitan cities. It was a point of difference in interviews, and perhaps helped just a little land my first job with a publisher at a time when it was becoming increasingly competitive to enter the industry. I'm still thoroughly enamoured of the city. For nearly 4 years after coming back, I would have dreams of being in Paris. But worse still, after the early dreams of being there again, I would start to recall the earlier dreams and tell myself, oh, how silly it was, of course that was a dream. When you're really here, the light is totally different, or the weather, or the smells. And my dreams would become more and more intricate as I fooled myself in new ways to believe that I was really back there. Thankfully, this particular cruelty has stopped. Since leaving, I've been back twice, and despite being incredibly ashamed at the deterioration of my French, I can confirm that the city holds just as strong a pull as ever. Its pedestrian-friendly streets, its love of eating well and attracting artists and valuing culture, and still the racism and the snobbery and the refusal to understand words pronounced even slightly differently remain. I couldn't speak about Paris in 2016 without mentioning the attacks at the end of last year. Like many Australians, I was dismayed to hear of the violence on 13 November. The news was being aired in Australia as I was getting ready for my brother's wedding in Canberra, and we were trying not to pay too much attention to it so as to maintain the happy mood of the day. But I have read and heard much more about it since. In my peer group, there have been two main reactions to the events. The first was horror and dismay at witnessing such awful things take place in the city that they love. The second was concern and sometimes anger that such a huge reaction was immediate and all-consuming for Paris, when only one day before there had been horrible attacks in Beirut. Why was it that there was so much more coverage in Australia for a country which has far fewer immigrants here? I don't think that the answer is straightforward, but I have some ideas as to why this is so. In most Australian schools, Arabic is not part of the curriculum. Arabic films are not shown as widely as French films. For a lot of people, daily life in Paris is more similar to life in Sydney or Melbourne than daily life in Beirut. I think that these are just some of the reasons why many people responded so strongly to Paris. I had a few friends who were there at the time, and I would like to just share one borrowed anecdote. A friend of mine lives in the 10th, not far from the cafe which was shot up, and not far from the Bataclan where there was the extended hostage situation. She was at home with her husband at the time when the attack started, and received alerts in her phone from Le Monde, advising her to stay at home. They followed the news online as the night unfolded, unsure of what the eventual scale was going to be. What would the ramifications for the city as a whole be? The next morning, on waking and reading that the immediate crises were over, she was vacillating over whether to go for a run. In part out of curiosity, and in part because of itchy feet, she decided to try out her usual route, and she was surprised at what she saw. In all of the parks on her way, on the footpaths, in the cafes, people were out and about. Swing sets creaked with children, old men were lined up to play bocce, and the terrace were peopled with Parisians having their breakfast. It was, for her, a most heartening sight after feeling the terror the night before. And I think it's one of the reasons why we love Paris so much. Most recently, I was there in April, which already feels too long an interval, and I am, as ever, planning my return. I still long for the way of life that Paris affords, the normalcy of art and culture, the approach to food and eating, though Sydney is doing its best to catch up, the amazing and amazingly cheap healthcare system, and maybe one day they will grudgingly have me back. Thank you.
Yes, and I forgot to mention that Alice is managing editor of Girmondo Publishing. Now we go to Ollie. Yeah, thank you.
Jared, thank you.
Alice? And Jared, maybe we have more in common than you think. So there's a contrast there, and Alice, I think I found the perfect co-author now. I think I had the wrong one to start with. Poor old Graham. He's in Paris as I speak, lucky him. I'll come back to that in a minute. And Alice, I can assure you that you can go into Shakespeare and Company. Not only that, if you go up one level, you can play the piano. And if you go up another level, if it's not already occupied, you can sleep there. So for the up-and-coming author and the hopeful author, there's a home in Paris. And so it's a wonderful place.
Sorry, they've also bought the place next door, which they've turned into a cafe.
Going to get on with this, all right?
Jared, do I have to behave myself?
No, the audience.
I was going to say, Jared, that thank you very much and for inviting us here. It's a prestigious organisation. I understand it's the first function for the year, and after a well-earned break, as we all know, I'm retired, so life is a well-earned break for me. But thank you. I have to say also that it's not necessarily the most prestigious offer I've had to speak about Paris and about the book. My son is a teacher, and he invited me to his third class at Innaburra. This is a real gig. I was invited to speak about French culture, and it was a challenge. I started by asking some questions, as you do, and I asked how many kids had actually been to Paris, and there were about 30 kids there, and a few hands shot up. I said, oh, that's great. And I said, how many have actually lived in Paris? And one kid put his hand up. I said, wow, that's fantastic. I said, how long were you in Paris for? How long did you live in Paris? He said, oh, 3 days. But I can understand why he would think that. It only takes a couple of days to be completely captivated by the place. And then you add in the fact that this is a city in some ways like no other, where everything's mixed up together. The offices, the cafes, the restaurants, the museums, the parliament, they're all in the same place. And even as a visitor, it feels like you're living there, and that's one of the great magnetic parts of Paris. I thought I'd make a few observations quickly, and just reflecting Alice's comment about Bataclan and the terror attacks. I also got the sense, that saying two things, that it deeply affected Parisians. They were very shocked by it, very rocked by it, and still are. But they have moved on, and they moved on quickly. And I very well remember the next day there. There was television coverage, obviously. The streets where it all happened were bare, with lots of police and barricades and so on. But there happened to be a passerby who was collared by the interviewer, and they had a brief interview. And she talked. It was probably 7 o'clock in the morning there, and she talked about, you know, how deeply affected she was. But under her arm was a baguette, and so life was going on for her. The bakery was baking, and she adopted the same life that she'd already had. So it's a remarkably resilient place. The place of Paris in our imagination, is there something special about the French connection with the Australians and vice versa? I don't know. I know that it started for me when I was at school and did a project on Paris, and when I was 11 or something, and you know, I've never forgotten the pictures that I saw of Place de la Concorde and Arc de Triomphe and so on. And from that moment on, I was captivated. My co-author, Graham, Now, here's a share something in common with Alice. His son lives in Paris, has done now for about 6 years, went there to write a novel. Sounds familiar? Now, shacked up is our generation's term, with a Parisian girl, they have a child, and he is still trying to write his novel. He'll get there in the end. My co-author's name is Graham Jones. You can't get more Anglo-Saxon than that. They named their son Mark, or they spelt his name M-A-R-C. Now, where did that come from? Here's a, you know, Aussie family. Did they know somewhere that he was going to become this European by default? Or by virtue of the fact that they called him Mark with a C, did he then become attracted to France and Paris? We don't know. As Dame Edna would say, it's a bit spooky. The title of this address today was Why Do We Love Paris, of course drawn from the Cole Porter song, where he sort of evokes Madame Bollinger, who talks about champagne being appropriate in the morning and in the afternoon, when you're alone, when you're in company, when you're sad, when you're happy. And Cole Porter talks about Paris being a place for all seasons, that he loves it in the spring, he loves it in the summer, he loves it in winter, and so on. And I think we all relate to that. Typically, I've been there in spring and autumn, but it has some magic at any time that you go. The last observation I just quickly want to make was about, again, about connection to Australia. And there's this thing out there that Sydney, the name Sydney, is derived from Paris or from France. And I don't know if you've heard this, Alice. There's a suburb in Paris, or it's outside the periphery, called Saint-Denis, and of course it was the place where some of the attacks took place recently. There is a theory that the word Sydney, originally Lord Sydney, has been derived from Saint-Denis. It's a circuitous language route. Is that possible? Is it Saint-Denis, Sydney? Well, I don't know. Maybe Samaranch knew more than we did when he announced the winner of the Olympics. So, I've got about 5 minutes to talk about Paris. I could talk about being the flaneur that Alice talked about. As Baudelaire said, it's a form of science. It's the gastronomy of the eye. This is walking about in Paris. And we all do it. It's a flat city. Every time you turn the corner, there's something more brilliant, more engaging, more captivating. And it's the best way to see Paris. Now, Graham's actually the world champion flaneur. He's in Paris at the moment again. His goal is to walk every street in Paris. He's been there, I guess, a little longer than I have. Collectively, I've been there, I suppose, about 20 weeks. He's probably been there maybe 30 or something over many trips. And he's, I think, halfway to walking every street in Paris. And he's armed with his Michelin map, book of maps. He has already walked all the bridges of Paris, all in a day and a half. There's 32 walkable bridges. And he crisscrossed the river. So he's the world champion flaneur. I'm not sure I'm up for all that, but anyway. So we could talk about that. We could talk about walking the streets of Paris. We could talk about the longest street in Paris, Vaugirard. Talk about the shortest, Rue des Degrés. And I'm just proving Alice's point that Australians can't speak French, but so we could talk about the wider street in Paris, which of course is the Champs-Élysées. It's not that much wider than Trundle, the main street of Trundle in central western New South Wales, but that's another story. We could talk about the market streets, and some of those are roving markets, some of them are permanent markets, the great experiences of Paris. We could talk about the green walks, the stately parks, the so-called lungs of Paris, Bois de Boulogne and Vincennes. We could talk about the grand boulevards of Paris. So, well, there's this amazing mixture of things that you can experience as you walk about. But I haven't got time for that. I just wanted to quickly bring people up to date, I think. Partly because there's a criticism about Paris that it's the famous phrase is a museum preserved in aspic. That it's just some sort of confected thing that's just stayed the same. Well, that's so wrong, because every time you go, there's something new, there's something different, there's something fantastic to experience. So what's happening there at the moment? There's a process that the mayor, current mayor Hidalgo, has started to make Paris more livable and cleaner. And they've been flushing out dog's poo for a while, which is very necessary, but she's upped the ante on that. They've been cleaning the facades of all the buildings on a regular basis for a while, and I think that's one of the examples of great civic pride in Paris. That's one of the other features, I think, that they're very proud of the history and heritage. They're reclaiming the riverbanks from... there was a period where the riverbanks were pedestrian, then they went through a process of being given over to cars. And they're now reclaiming those riverbanks for pedestrians. First example of that was the Paris plages, the Paris beaches, and now they are turning some of those roadways into pedestrian roads, the latest being just opposite the islands. And so there's this focus on renewing, keeping Paris as a livable city. And it's far from being a museum. Is that a hooter? They're banning plastic bags in shops. And then there, of course, is what we all go to Paris for. It's always something new. The latest is this magnificent museum in the Bois de Boulogne, the Louis Vuitton Fondation. And it's a Frank Gehry building, all sails and glass and modernism, and a wonderful building. And inside, obviously, magnificent arts, works of art. And so all of a sudden, here it is, not much fanfare, world class, there it is. And every time you go to Paris, there's something new like that. They're renewing many of the museums, Rodin, Picasso. So there's this constant change and constant renewal. So that's broadly what I wanted to say. I was going to quickly read out of the last pages of the book, if 5 minutes.
A little bit less.
I do this because in some ways... this book is clearly a love affair with Paris. It's no, unashamedly a love affair with Paris. But Paris isn't perfect. What is the real Paris? And here I bastardise John Steinbeck. Is it a sonnet, a stench, an endless noise, a characteristic life, a timbre, an addiction, a reminiscence, a melancholy. Is it the grand boulevards and monuments, which just about everyone is rightly impressed by? Is it the captivating alleys of the historical Marais, preserved intact after all these years? But where were the bars and boutiques there in the 17th century? How then could this be the real Paris? Perhaps it's Faubourg Saint-Antoine, with its roots in left-wing protest and agitation, and its reputation as the home of the noble artisan and humble worker. Maybe it's in the neighbouring Belleville, Ménilmontant sector, which is another melting pot of change, and where in 1840 the word communist first gained currency anywhere in the world, and this is of course near the Bataclan Theatre. Is the real Paris the blank, weary faces of commuters on the metro as they travel to and from La Banlieue to their places of work? Is it perhaps the soulless Banlieue itself, where the majority of Parisians live after all? Could the real Paris be the riot of traffic, the infuriating confusion of buses, cars, motorbikes, pedestrians and bicycles competing for priority access? Could it be the beggars, not all of them professional, and the homeless who seem to beset all Western cities now? Maybe it's the black faces of the Moroccan and Algerian sectors, or the language, food and dress of the increasingly present Muslim population. Is it an oh-so-elegant night at the ballet, in tie and jacket, a Garnier, or rather in the bleachers in scarf and club colours and flare at the ready at Parc des Princes? Will the real Paris meal today be afternoon tea at La Durée, steak frites at Hippopotamus, the Hippopotamou, or Le Big Mac at McDonald's? Is it the immaculately clean golden building facades, or is it the dog shit setting smelly traps for the unwary? Well, Paris is all of those things. It's not perfect, but what a wonderful place to be. Thank you.
And so we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than the top of the hour. So I'll get Alice back here and Ollie back there, and people can ask, come around here. And so I might just start off by being a bit... a bit more critical, I think. It was a very interesting book, I should say. Paris Tragics. Janet Grundy's got copies of it, and I'm sure Ollie would be happy to sign it. Ollie spoke about being completely captivated. When I think of France, I mean, and the Australian-French relationship, when I think of the Australian-French relationship, I think of Sir Roden Cutler, who lost a leg fighting the Vichy France in North Africa. Not many Australians understand that we're at war with France during the Second World War, with Vichy France, which was majority France. And when I look at Paris and I go, they're a wonderful city, but I see that it survived because the French surrendered in 1940 and allowed the Germans to bomb Britain and to then to move into Eastern Europe. And we know what happened there. So I know in recent years the French have been acknowledging their history much more than they had previously, but it's still a rather unpleasant history, I think, since it hasn't been acknowledged very much. Nothing like the Germans have acknowledged their history. So how do you French lovers, Paris lovers, think about that?
I think you warned me before I went that near the Australian Embassy in Paris, there is a very small plaque for the Velodrome. I don't know if you remember telling me that story. And there were horrific things that happened in the Velodrome for the city's Jewish population. And if it were in Berlin, then there would be a proper monument. And I travelled to Berlin on this visit when I was staying in Paris, and I was really surprised and pleased to see the way that the Germans were dealing with their history and acknowledging it and being open about it. And it was one of my frustrations with the French. And I would occasionally bring it up with my peers, and they were not comfortable talking about it. They weren't happy talking about it. Whereas I think in Australia, when you talk about mistakes that Australians have made in the past, for instance, with Indigenous people, I feel as though we're getting better at talking about those mistakes. And I think that in France, they're not there yet.
Ollie.
Maybe it's something to do, Jared, with the difference between Paris and being French. The French fancy themselves as intellectuals, and there's no doubt they've added amazing intellectual depth to society. They are very blunt and critical of things that they don't agree with. They're not so good at taking criticism, and I think that's a fair point, and I think there's something about the French that, as Alice has mentioned, us Aussies don't necessarily connect with. So I'll be a little bit sort of, what's the word? This is the capital of hedonism. And I'd make no apology about that. This is the capital of pleasure. But it's a very sophisticated, it's the pinnacle of our civilization in respect of art, of music, of literature, of food, of fashion, of architecture, to name a few. And so as a lover of Paris, I connect with that. And that's meaningful to me. That may mean I'm somewhat superficial, I don't know. But that's very meaningful. So that's what it is to me. Can I live with its not so pretty past? If I think about it in that way, I can. Yeah.
Okay, now we've got plenty of time. If I repeat anything so it gets picked up on the pod, there's a question, and we go over here. Here, yeah.
The capital of food.
This is directed at.
No,
okay.
But particularly that phrase was used by just a moment ago. I like Paris. I enjoyed being in Paris. But the one thing that disappointed me about Paris was that I'd been led to believe it was the capital of food, that the gastronomic quality of Paris was beyond measure. When we're in Paris for 2 weeks...
We've got to be quick. Okay.
Yes, go on.
Okay, you go on. Be quick, yeah.
We ate in some good restaurants and were disappointed on every occasion. The best food we had was sitting on the hotel bed with stuff we'd bought at the local supermarket.
Okay, all right.
And patisserie.
This is the My
Can
Kitchen...
you comment on?
This is the My Kitchen Rules question. How bad's the food is the question.
My supermarket.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I will say that I think that supermarkets in France are a wonder, as are pharmacies. In my experience, the standard of food was very high, and it depends on what you like and what you're after. I will say that after a few months in Paris, we thought we would treat ourselves to a Thai dinner because we were missing Thai food. And it was a relatively expensive place and we didn't have much money, and so sort of saving up and getting ready for this special experience. And I can tell you it bore no resemblance to Thai food. It was very depressing and it was a big fat waste of money. I don't think you have to spend a lot of money to eat very well in Paris, and that's one of my favourite things. And in fact, on my most recent trip, the best meal that I had was just on the east side of Sacré-Cœur. If you go down a little bit, there's a neighbourhood there that's locals rather than tourists, and just went down the street, picked up some cheese from the cheese shop, some wine from the wine shop, some bread from the bakery, and had that sitting on the steps, and that was the best meal I had that trip.
Ollie. Here, Alice. Look, it's a favourite topic of mine. I could speak for days on it. France and Paris set the standard. Probably dropped the ball for a while. It's come back. And there's everything from, as Alice said, you know, the baguette from the local boulangerie, through to the very high end. And my favourite restaurant is a restaurant called Taillevent, where I have had two meals which were incomparable. I've never had food or service anything like it anywhere in the world. And so high quality exists and exists in a big way, and in some ways is affordable. If you, for example, go for the menu du jour in a restaurant like Taylor Hall, it's expensive but it's affordable. So I've carefully watched this over the years, because sure, we've had some crap food in Paris, absolutely, as you do anywhere. But the overall standard of professionalism and care for good quality ingredients and the way the food is prepared and presented, I think it's marvellous. Now, it's not to say there isn't great food elsewhere, and Australia's a good example, but I think standards can be set there.
There's a question here. Yes?
In relation to whether France and Paris acknowledges its part during the Second World War, Ollie, have you observed the plaques on the side of the schools in Paris, which sets out that a number of Jewish children were taken from this school and deported to the concentration camps? It always seems to me that that's very moving, it's very embarrassing, and it's very public.
No, I haven't noticed that.
There's a question about plaques on the walls of schools about the Jewish kids who have been deported, which you can read with a microscope, I think. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, not with a microscope. They're legible on the street. Yeah, it's true. I've seen those. And there is a Jewish museum in Paris now. I think that, you know, that's a legitimate point, but I think that on the whole, the country hasn't yet fully come to terms with its past.
I think it's happening, but I hadn't noticed that, so no.
Question there?
Yeah.
I'm interested in your comment, Alice, about the girls in the dress shop, because a granddaughter of mine had a very similar experience on an exchange in northern Italy, that the way in which you keep your Parisian figure or your European figure is to smoke and eat nothing all day, including when you're 16 and 15. So you can pretend that, you know, you love food and stay thin. Now, how widespread is that? Because it rang a bell with me,
yeah.
And it does sound very healthy.
Yeah, it's not healthy, and I think it's really widespread. And I think that when you, particularly the kinds of women I'm talking about, it's not as though they were stupid or necessarily easily influenced. It's just part of the culture. If you go into the supermarket, half of the water bottles have stickers on them saying, "This is slimming water." I have no idea what that is. But I do think that there's a really unhealthy chauvinistic attitude towards women in France. And I found this, I had this very strange dynamic going to parties or, you know, in social situations. And I would speak my mind, and I would be opinionated, and often it was in relatively poor French, but, you know, I would try to make jokes and have my normal personality. And often French men would say to me, "Oh, I love Australian women, it's so refreshing." But when it came to their own girlfriends, the way that they treated them did not reflect that sort of attitude. And so this is 8 years ago, and, you know, I'm hoping that it's a little better now, but I'm not particularly confident on that front.
Well, I do know anything about dieting and fitting into size 8 or 6 or something. Can you help us out?
Well, what can I say? One of my friends described the book as Paris seen through the eyes of two sophisticated Aussie larrikins. So what can I say, having that label? There's an oxymoron in there somewhere. The French women I know, some in Paris, some here, are very able to stand up for themselves. So if they are treated badly, if they are treated in a sort of typical male way, then the ones I know have the intelligence, the assertiveness, and the social skills to fight back.
To respond to that, I mean, they were 18, 19, 20. So hopefully many grow out of that. And I have French friends in Australia who are perfectly capable of standing up for themselves.
Sure.
But in terms of an overall feeling, the kinds of characters that are represented on TV, what you see in the supermarkets, what you see in the pharmacies, I think from the marketing, you do get the impression that there's definitely a strong chauvinist push.
Yep.
Oh, no, here and then over there. Yeah. Yes.
I'd just like to make an observation on your comments on language. If 10 years ago French expected foreigners to speak French, however now this has all changed. When the 40-year-olds who've now come back from studying business in the United States, there's a whole change. And now it is everyone in Paris speaks English. Mm. And they don't look down on you. If you're making an attempt, I know you had, you were talking about 2008.
Yeah.
In fact, now we send our students from university to a provincial town because in Paris they only want to speak French and practice their French.
Yes. The suggestion is increasingly English is being spoken in Paris, but not necessarily in other parts of France.
Yeah, to a point, I would say, but well, two responses. One is the way French people speak English can often leave something to be desired because of their own laziness. I remember going to a cafe, and I asked the man in a carefully prepared sentence if they had a table, and he looked at me and he said, "Lunch." And I said, repeated what I said because I had no idea what he was talking about. He said, "Lunch!" And I apologised. I said, "I'm really sorry. I don't understand you all in French." And he said, "Lunch, lunch, you want to eat lunch?" Ah, okay, lunch. So, you know, maybe English speakers are part of the problem as well. I think that the educated and the university-educated class in France and those who... and they do teach English in school. But I find, you know, if you go to the post office or if you go to the bakery, places like that, you do still need to speak French to people working in those jobs.
Ollie?
That first encounter, yes, if you try to speak French, it's generally appreciated, and yes, there's a general willingness to meet halfway. But I've experienced the full range. I've experienced people who want to make fun of you because of your French, people who refuse to speak to you because they know you're going to butcher their language and they won't put up with it. So I've had the full range. But I agree, the Parisians are able to meet you halfway. The aspect of the French, you know, not speaking English too well, I've had exactly the same. I had a pharmacist who prescribed drips for both eyes, and it took me a while to work out it was drops for both eyes. So we've had all of that.
Now we're coming rapidly to the top of the hour, so we've got to have quick questions and responses. So there's one there and there's one there. Yeah.
Given Paris is an inclusive sort of place, we're not wishing to seem Islamophobic for a moment. Why do you think it is that the French government is failing to stop a massive exodus of Jewish people?
So the question is, why is the French government not able to stop a mass exodus of Jewish people? Right, so...
Well, I don't really have the answer to that, except to say that there have been attacks on Jewish schools, and I can understand around the time of Charlie Hebdo, and I can understand parents being worried for their children, but I don't have any further response.
Ollie?
It sort of implies they're not doing enough. Sarkozy banned the burqa and the niqab some years ago, so they've been very conscious of this issue for a long time. Now, whether they've done enough, I don't know. But it's not something they've buried their heads in the sand about. So that's all I'd say.
It's a question here.
To what extent is the migrant population changing or influencing the culture in Paris?
Changing or influencing the culture in Paris?
I hope it's having a positive effect. I think that it can only increase tolerance so long as there are open-minded French people to accept and engage with the culture, and not just at the level of food. If it can also be at the level of trying to understand each other's religions and cultures. So hopefully there will be progress, and hopefully the kind of racism that I was talking about will dissipate over time, but I'm not especially confident about that.
I think it's having a massive effect. So on the one hand, there's sort of preservation of what Paris is and what it means and its historical heritage and so on. On the other hand, this inevitable influence of various cultures, and you see it in the streets. And as I made comment in one of the chapters of the book, you know, I went there on that occasion with my wife, and had seen gayer, blacker, and so on. You know, you could see it happening in front of you over the years. So I think it's having a massive effect. One of the ironies of the terrorist attacks is that they've taken place in parts of Paris, in arrondissements, where there is a greater multicultural mix. This is in the 10th and 11th and 12th, and in Saint-Denis. And so there's this irony going on of Muslims probably killing more Muslims than they needed to had they held the attacks in, you know, near the Arc de Triomphe, for example. So it's just, there are lots of complexity going on, as there is here, obviously. And I think it's having
just
massive
finally
effect.
And finally, very briefly, how did you go about writing your book?
Oh.
I mean, why did you do it and how did you go about it?
I did it because it was good fun at the time for want of something better to do. And there was this coincidence of my mate, my old schoolmate Graham, and I sort of independently, because we've hardly been there together, falling in love with Paris at the same time. And he came back with a little sketchbook. So he did all the illustrations. And the sketchbook had a few notations on it, and it was about 20 pages, and it was his little story of Paris. And we sat around watching the footy, and I said to him, "Why don't we write a book?" And he said, "You're kidding." And I said, "No, why not?" And so that's how it happened.
Many thanks. So, as I said, Janet Groney's got copies of Paris Tragics. So many thanks to our speakers tonight for what's been informative, but above all, I think entertaining, which is really what we're all about here. So many thanks to Ollie Butowski and to Alice Grundy. I'm just thinking of some of the illustrations here. My mind's wandering. So well done, Alice, again, and well done, Ollie, and good luck with your book. And we'll have you back sometime to talk about something else.
Early.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.